Glad you said it. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parsetoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taken my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars, the moon. I join the morning praising you. Allah, 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 Allah.
This is Arab English Radio from Tehran. We're now going over to Press TV headquarters here in Tehran for a special program, a roundtable discussion. Exactly a year ago today, the top Iranian general, Haji Qasem Soleimani, was martyred in a terrorist drone strike by U.S. military forces near Baghdad airport. Let's go over to Press TV for this special program.
Forces Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas. We're looking at the effects of what took place and what General Soleimani had done for the region and beyond. You're also right now looking at these live images coming from Kerman. That is General Soleimani's hometown, where throughout this week there have been programs commemorating the general, his life, what he stood for. People have gathered from all over the country and actually from other countries also, and to show their respect once again for the general and what he has done. Again, you're looking at these live images coming from his hometown of Kerman here in Iran. I'd like to welcome my guests to this section of the program. Here in Tehran, Mr. Mostafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political commentator, and Omar Nashabi from Al Akhbar out of Beirut. Thank you very much. We're going to start it off with Omar out of Beirut. Again, thanks for being with us. Your perspective, what does General Soleimani, when you think about him, what comes to mind? What did he stand for and what did he represent?
Yes. Well, it's been a year. It's been a year since the assassination, the terrorist operation, the terrorist attack that assassinated General Qasem Soleimani. General Qasem Soleimani, for us in Lebanon, is someone who was coordinating, who had basically three things that come to mind when we think about General Qasem Soleimani. One, he had supported the resistance. And not one day, and I heard this from many, many people who worked in the resistance during Israeli occupation and in the years that followed, never did they ask for any support and they didn't get it. They always got it. And General Soleimani was always very fast in actually making sure that whatever was needed for the people of Lebanon to fight foreign occupation, especially Israeli occupation, and the Israeli attacks and aggressions against Lebanon, General Qasem Soleimani was always ready to provide to the resistance whatever was needed, no matter how difficult it was. Because, you know, the Israelis and the Americans have advanced capacity to actually block any support that, people could get from Lebanon or that the resistance could get. And therefore, the contribution of General Soleimani was central. That is on the support level. On the coordination level, General Qasem Soleimani was able to coordinate between the various resistance groups in Lebanon and in the region. And that was so important. It's not by accident that he was assassinated. He was with a leader of the Iraqi resistance. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry, because the screen blocked. I mean, I thought maybe the...
No problem. Go ahead.
There was a problem in the technical communication. The third thing is that he participated directly in the field. I mean, he was there, and he speaks Arabic. He knows Arabic, so therefore people felt that he was even closer to them because he spoke the language of the people, whether it's in Iraq or in Syria or in Lebanon. And he knew, for me, Qasem Soleimani could very well be an Arab leader. He spoke Arabic, he looked like Arab, and you know, Iranians and Arabs look alike. So they couldn't differentiate if Qasem Soleimani was a foreigner. He wasn't considered as a foreigner, neither in Lebanon, nor in Syria, nor in Iraq. He was a native. When he came to Lebanon, he was like a Lebanese. I mean, we felt that he was one of the people who have lived here all along. And I think in Syria and in Iraq, it was the same thing. And so therefore, direct support, coordination, and participating in field work, I mean, these are the three things that come to my mind when I think about Qasem Soleimani.
Okay. Well, Mostafa, your take on the effect of what he did on security in this region and beyond.
Well, General Soleimani did something that even people, if it hadn't been for the confessions made by the U.S. officials, too many U.S. officials in front of the cameras and in the media, nobody would believe what he's done so far. I mean, he defused the large-scale strategic plans of the United States in the Middle East twice, between the years 2001 and 2007, and a second time from 2011 to 2017. Both times, they were defeated, the United States and its allies in the region, especially the second time, in the second period that I just mentioned, they were defeated by the by Soleimani, made Lieutenant General Soleimani, and the Quds Force. You know, back in 2011, 2001, the United States went for exercising its greater Middle East plan in order to disintegrate the regional nations in the Middle East, in order to push them into chaos and eternal strife and wars, so as to wear off their power and to engage them in internal wars and struggles against each other. The only country or regime would be left intact and to be regarded as a major power in the Middle East or West Asia would be the Israeli regime, and they would have a much easier task to do to overcome these small, disintegrated, warring nations to conquer their lands and occupy their territories to expand to expand Israel. Also, the U.S. would have the upper hand to impose its order in the Middle East, and they would resolve their problem with imposing their hegemony over the Middle East once and for all. And then they could shift to the Far East, to pivot east, as the Obama doctrine called it, in order to present a new challenge, a major challenge to the growing economy, China, in there, in order to slow down the speed of this superpower that would soon replace the United States power as the top number one world power. So General Soleimani did this through introducing his own mobilization strategy. He started with popular groups. They modeled on the Iran besieged or mobilized forces, and then they could succeed to such extent, and he went to such extremes that when the commander of the U.S. forces intended to retreat from Iraq, they called General Soleimani asking him for insurances that they would not come under attack as they were retreating. So this is Iraq and not Iran. So they were defeated. And I quite remember pretty well that in a Senate hearing back in 2016, when they were about to ratify the State Department's budget for the fiscal year of 2007, Condoleezza Rice, who was the Secretary of State in the second George Bush administration, she came under very fervent attack, very harsh attacks, actually, by Senator Obama, Senator John Kerry, Senator Biden, and others, who were telling her what kind of a foreign strategy and foreign policy strategy is this, because we have lost billions of dollars, thousands of billions of dollars, and we have lost several thousand soldiers, but we have toppled Iran's rival in Afghanistan and Iraq, and two replacing governments, they are aligned with Iran, they are allies of Iran right now. And then in Lebanon, the last time the Israeli regime withdrew from southern Lebanon, it took him 20 years, but this time in 2006, it took him 33 days only, and they were defeated and they were humiliated. Mm-hmm. And then in Palestine, there has been a free parliamentary election, and the group that's closer to Iran, Islamic Jihad and Hamas, have taken power and they've been elected. And in our backyard, in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in any country in Latin America, the country, those parties that are enemies of the United States, they are socialists and they are closer to Iran, and the ones that chant death to America, that's exactly their words, the senator's words, They chant death to America. They come to power. And they are closer to Iran. What kind of foreign policy is this? So that's exactly the session that started many plans against Iran in order to contain Iran and Iran's power. And
okay, stay with me, Mostafa. Stay with me, Mostafa. Let me get Omar back in on this. Omar, you had talked, and also Mostafa talked about as far as that beyond the Iranian border element of General Soleimani. You talked about him basically being a Lebanese or being an Iraqi or wherever he was. I want to talk about the importance of being able to coordinate and befriend and form this very strong alliance when dealing with the opposite forces and what the United States did and the various regimes that were plotting against the region and the way that General Soleimani was able to counter those terrorists.
Yes, and I think that, yes, and I appreciate what you just, your guest talked about a minute ago. I want to focus on the coordinating role, because, you know, the Americans and the Israelis and their intelligence agencies and some also regional intelligence agencies, they always try to create problems and difficulties within the same front. This is the front of the resistance. And I think one of the most important victories of General Qasem Soleimani or achievements was that he was able to coordinate between various groups that were not always very friendly, you know, and he was able to maintain a certain, you know, cooperation between everybody and try to get them together so that we can remain a united front facing American Western occupation and assaults on the regions and Israeli continuous occupation of Palestine. So between various Palestinian resistance groups, for example, General Qasem Soleimani has an important role. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, leader of Hezbollah, recently said that talked about the missiles, the Cornet missiles that were bought by the Syrian army by President Assad, and then they were the Syrian army gave these missiles to Hezbollah so that Hezbollah can use them against the Israeli tanks, you know, the Merkava, also the military equipment that is advanced from the Israelis needed some advanced equipment. And recently, and Nasrallah revealed that recently, before the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, General Soleimani asked if we could give some of these missiles all the way to our brothers in Gaza, in the resistance to Hamas. And this is just an example of how determined General Qasem Soleimani was to continue with the resistance and arming the resistance, and as close as possible, and in the heart of the confrontation zone that is inside the occupied Palestine. He wanted to get the weapons, advanced weapons, to give to the Palestinian people so that the Palestinian people can fight to gain back what belongs to them according to international law. This is under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, the right of the Palestinian people to resist and to acquire weapons from wherever. And here was General Qasem Soleimani to coordinate between Hezbollah and the Syrians in order to get these weapons and get the Cornet missiles and ensure that they would arrive to Gaza. In fact, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, when he said this to President Assad, President Assad, as he said, was surprised. He told him, how can you get these missiles all the way to Gaza? And I think the answer was General Qasem Soleimani. He was the one who could get the weapons to Gaza. And that is very important. He could ensure that that the support that the resistance needs can be ensured. He had capacities that were extraordinary, and I think that these capacities are still there.
Okay.
Because General Soleimani knew that they will come to assassinate him, and therefore I am sure that he put a plan B in place, and the plan B is in place, and the resistance will persevere.
Well, Mustafa, what about what Omar was talking about, that ability for him to coordinate? I wonder, because you had touched on the situation in Lebanon, and we know the image that Israel likes to propel is one of invincibility. But as you had stated earlier, talking about the 33-day war, 2006, and what happened, I want to look at that and how the general was able to expand, basically, this security, if you want to say, because we know prior to that what had happened, Israel was what it was doing in Lebanon, and we know as far as Syria, and then we saw Iraq. But when the general got involved, it's amazing. It seems like he was the utmost strategist. I want to look at that aspect right now as far as being able to expand security in the region.
You know, he was genius because he could see things pretty well, and he could foresee things and predict future situations. He could see that there was a world war going to happen in the region, and he had a plan. Always he had several plans, and then he knew how to deal with this world war. He knew that when you're faced with terrorists coming to Syria from 84 nations, then you need to mobilize all your forces from Afghanistan to Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, from the Druze community, Sunni community, Alawi communities, Shiite communities, seculars, anyone along the common points. Those commonalities matter a lot, and he knew how to avoid those features and those things that could antagonize people against each other, alienate groups from the main point, that's war against terrorism. And he knew how to stress commonalities, so he avoided a religious antagonism and religious bigotry or radicalism. And he always displayed the kind face of Islam to everyone. He neglected mistakes when they were not vital military mistakes. So as a matter of fact, that was the way he defeated the U.S. Plan and the plan of the United States and its allies in the region, according to the documents that we have. Between the years 2011 and 2017.
It's interesting what you said, Mustafa, because you said he went beyond as far as the various differences, whether we're talking about being religious, secular, or various religious affiliation. And you pointed that out, and I want to look at that, because that is one of the main issues that we have seen from the past historically, whether we're talking about England when they started the divide and conquer, or we see the U.S. regime continuing the same thing, continually trying to promote, especially in this region, sectarian differences, and how someone like General Soleimani, not only himself obviously, was way beyond that, but was able to get all these different groups and entities to think as one, and that was a resistance.
Well, I know seculars in Lebanon that adore the resistance and Qasem Soleimani and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. There are too many. And that's because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and General Soleimani, they honor the differences. They know that the United States is trying to use the Sunni-Shiite strife, because they have been acknowledging that. General Dempsey, who was the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff of the U.S. back in 2014, he acknowledged in a Senate hearing to Lindsey Graham that it was Saudi Arabia that was planting and supporting this war, this terrorist groups, including Daesh or ISIS, ISIL, whatever it is, in Syria and Iraq. We also have the acknowledgments made by Jake Sullivan, who told Hillary Clinton in a cable that was released by the WikiLeaks that Al-Qaeda in Syria is on our side. So General Soleimani knew pretty well what they are doing, and he tried to defuse it, and he did it pretty well, because some of the most devoted soldiers and units, military units that were fighting for him and for his noble cause. They were from the Sunnis. They were from the Druze. They were from people, Alawi people, Shiites, and from various nations, because he could see how they were trying to divide Muslims of this nation along the lines of sectarianism, and he avoided that, and he could do the opposite, and he showed that it's not a Sunni-Shiite war. This is a war against the United States hegemony. This is a war against Israel. This is a war against Wahhabism and radicalism, okay, no matter who you are.
And on that note, sorry, but we're going to have to end it. I appreciate both of you being with us for a very fast-paced, actually, half hour. Sorry it passed so fast, but I appreciate both of you being with us. Omar Ashabi from Al-Akhbar out of Beirut. Mustafa Khushchash, journalist and political commentator out of Tehran. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us and staying with us right here at Press TV. Don't go away. I'll be back in about 4 minutes.
This is Arabic Radio from Tehran. You've just listened to a special program on the first anniversary of the terrorist assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was killed in a terror attack carried out by a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad Airport on 3rd of January 2020, exactly a year ago. This was a special program by Press TV. We now go back to our regular programming here on Arabi English Radio.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So we have been talking about the mistakes parents often do when bringing up their children, and you have been talking about some of the mistakes. In the previous program, we talked about hypocrisy, and then you talked about humiliating a child near others, which in fact, unfortunately, is being done quite often. So I was hoping you could, you know, build on this.
As far as humiliating a child is concerned, we do it sometimes inadvertently also. So I mentioned some examples. Mostly, we probably would refrain from humiliating a child like making him feel so upset in front of everyone. I think it's wrong. But we think that the small things are okay, like scolding a child, comparing a child, but that's also humiliating, so we should refrain from that. Parents sometimes make such small mistakes. They think they are small, but in actuality, they are even quite big mistakes that go a long way and affect the children's self-esteem and the personality in the long run.
Yeah.
There's another mistake, common mistake that the parents make is making education, the secular education, appear more
important
than the Islamic education.
Uh-huh.
Normally that happens a lot, especially in other countries apart from, even in, for example, Islamic countries, they just, okay, it's not a wrong thing to make them pursue secular education if they want to. In fact, it's good to let them make their own decisions as they grow up.
Yeah.
But not to lay more importance to the Western or the secular education compared to the Islamic education. Islamic education is something that is so important. It gives the child the answers to the purpose of his life.
I think because the parents, they have not understood really the importance of the Islamic knowledge, and they always feel it's secondary, especially because the world has come to a point where they have degraded the Islamic system and everything. So now it's just in the minds of parents and people generally that Islamic studies are not as important as...
Yeah, unfortunately. And okay, as far as to get a career for the child and the child to want to pursue on something, it's not wrong to pursue on something else, but here my point is not to lay emphasis on this kind of knowledge compared to Islamic knowledge, because Islamic knowledge provides all the answers to the purpose of life and why we are here.
Yeah.
Right? Because sometimes there comes a point in life that a child will feel empty. Sometimes that why am I doing this? At the end of the day, what does it give me? That satisfaction is not got. Money is collected, everything is there. You know, I'm successful, but I have to die one day. What's there now? What's the use, you know, of
exactly.
All this toil and trouble, earning, and then you have to leave it aside. So Islam gives answers to all this, yeah? So
yeah.
The Islamic knowledge should be really laid emphasis on from a young age. But of course, with the secular studies can be done at the side. Like we here send our children to school, and we also give importance to secular education. But the way we stress on Islamic education for our children, because it takes them all the way from this world to the hereafter.
Exactly.
That's what we actually want, that kind of success for our children, right?
Very true. But we're just going to take a short break, and inshallah, after the break, we're going to continue this discussion. Please stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. We were talking about how parents humiliate their children near others, and you also brought this topic that unfortunately parents tend to treat the secular education as more important than Islamic education.
Which is a common mistake that they do.
Yeah.
So when the child grows up, they have little or no knowledge of Islam. And then they can easily fall prey to misconceptions and lies that others feel him. You know, child, when he gets, as he's growing up, he gets influenced by the environment, the friends around him, the media. So whatever they say, they feel, yeah, they are right. Now that he's come to understand and rationalize, you see. Instead of inculcating that habit from a young age and then, you know, explaining later on when they start understanding conceptual values.
Yeah.
But if he is not given those kind of practice and knowledge of Islam, then easily he will fall prey to misconceptions and form wrong ideas. By that time, it will be too late to want the goodness of the child, right? To want the success of the child in the hereafter as well. So this is one of the disadvantages that this mistake of taking lightly the Islamic knowledge brings about. And I believe in this generation, Muslims more than ever need to know and understand their religion, so that they would withstand all the pressures of being a Muslim. You know, in this day and age, Muslims are so much under pressure, right? they always been called terrorists and things like that.
Yeah.
So there's so much way to make a person realize that Muslims have got a main beautiful goal ahead, an aim to reach, and that is a beautiful goal. It's something that is so much suited to our nature also. People should be informed, children should be informed about these things, but it comes instilling in a very young age.
Yeah.
Then they are able to accept it, to after the practice and they see the beauty of it, and then they come to realize the conceptual bit of it, then they will understand and accept it rather than being led by the wind whenever they, you know,
exactly,
like
misconceptions take. I think, like, because, for example, for me, most of my siblings came to study and they were, you know, they became talabis. From when I was young, I was instilled with this kind of point of view that, and at those times it was that prime time that it's Muslims are bad, Muslim are terrorists, you know, ISIS and all of that. But because of being taught this way that, you know, how important Islam is and what our goal is and why they are so against Islam and that's why they are, you know, changing us with this bad name, I felt like that is how, as I was growing, I was feeling like I was appreciating Islam so much more. It's because of this kind of, you know, information I was given, slowly instilled even through the actions of my family, that helped me, you know, understand Islam much more.
Yeah, and it's so good the way you said it, it made you appreciate,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Islam. So as the secular knowledge or the secular atmosphere is there, maybe the atmosphere in the other countries are so un-Islamic, then you learn to appreciate Islam more.
Yeah.
If it's taught to you at an early tender age.
Exactly.
Not taught to you at the age that when you've got instilled those kind of other concepts that are un-Islamic, right?
Yeah.
So this Islamic religion to take importance of is of a very crucial importance.
Exactly. All right, so we're just going to take a short break and we will be back for more on this topic just after the break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "The fathers pray for children as useful, like water is for plants."
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So you were telling us about how we should try and instill in our children from a young age of what Islam is and the beauty of Islam and what our goal is.
Yeah, by laying stress on the Islamic knowledge rather than the secular knowledge.
Yes.
Of course, both are go hand in hand, but Islamic knowledge has to be laid stressed more upon because it takes the children a long way from, you know, towards the success, not only in this world, rather also in the hereafter.
Yeah.
Now, there's another common mistake that parents usually do, by mistake, of course, is the lack of family time, communication. Mm-hmm. It's so important, you know, and all that attention and love and everything comes under this. The lack of family time. You know, it's sad to see parents and children losing touch because everybody is busy with their own technology.
Yeah.
Technology has made this kind of detrimental effect on the human beings in such a way that they've lost communication between them. You may see them sitting in front of each other with their own mobiles or laptops or TV or newspapers or whatever. That's not the thing that Islam wants from a family atmosphere. A family atmosphere should understand each other, be warm with each other, talk to each other, relate their problems, give solutions to each other,
yeah,
discuss with each other, respect each other, make themselves feel loved and respected towards each other. Allah loves that, and so much stress is laid on that. The family relationship should be so strong. So, unfortunately, little stress is laid on maintaining these home relationships. Because you see sometimes, you know, men coming in their own time, women having, you know, slept at that time, maybe they have eaten their meals with their children, or everybody has different times to suit themselves.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't bring that barakat and the togetherness and that understanding between each other. Sometimes even if the man comes late, which he's not supposed to, of course, and there should be a certain time that he should be at home so that he can have at least one meal with his family,
yeah,
right? In order to feel that, make them feel that warmth, have a communication with them, show them their affection, the affection and love that they require.
Definitely.
Or else, you know, what will happen? The children look for it elsewhere. when children see that parents are not communicating with them, even sometimes due to some influence, they have their own, you know, homeworks, and probably they, in this day and age, like what we have, we are facing the situation now, everybody has their own online classes and things like that. So it's so much, you know, everything is online, computerized, mobiles and things like that. But this should not drift us apart, I feel. This should make us feel, you know, that now these things, we are sick and tired of them.
Yeah.
They come a point in time that you feel you just don't want to touch your phone because you want to give that attention solely to your child.
Exactly.
I have experienced that a lot of times, and I just put my mobiles away and people start calling me all the time and I wouldn't even know. And I know, well, if it's not very urgent, maybe I can reply them. But if there's no need and you know that there's no expectation of answering right at the moment, then yeah, these things can be left aside and warm communication can be replaced and compensated for with the children. That's what they need the most.
Exactly.
The energy is being exchanged.
Yeah, so I guess in these situations, the best thing is to plan your day, to plan your times, to keep a good timetable, whereby even if you have classes or you have to keep a special time with your child, also make sure to keep a special time for your child with the child's father. So this all works with, you know, planning and in keeping a timetable, inshallah.
Yeah. Even if the father has to give some time, quality time, it's very necessary for him to do so.
Yeah.
Make sure that he does so. That communication spirit should remain. Not that the child should not see the one parent the whole day and sleep and then in the morning, oh, I didn't see you yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
He becomes used to the fact that even if he doesn't see his parents, okay for him. But because that gap is there of wanting to have be loved and attended to, he'll look for it elsewhere. And that's when, you know, the danger creeps.
It's true, very true. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. So, dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, bi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way, it's a complete way.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Donald Trump's fellow Republicans in the U.S. Senate on Friday, 1st of January 2021, took the atypical rebellious step of overriding his veto for the first time in his presidency. The Senate pushed through a bill on defense spending against Donald Trump's strong objections, with just 20 days left before Donald Trump leaves office. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, Senate Overrides Donald Trump's Veto of Defense Spending Bill. Stay with us for more of Edward Helmore's article. Donald Trump's fellow Republicans in the U.S. Senate on Friday, 1st of January 2021, took the atypical rebellious step of overriding his veto for the first time in his presidency. The Senate pushed through a bill on defense spending against Donald Trump's strong objections just 20 days before Trump leaves office. Meeting in a rare New Year's Day session, the Senate secured the two-thirds majority needed to override the veto with bipartisan support 2 days before a new Congress will be sworn in on Sunday. 8 previous vetoes of legislation have been upheld. Under the U.S. Constitution, the President has the power to veto a bill passed by Congress, but lawmakers can uphold the bill if two-thirds of both the House of Representatives and the Senate vote to override it. The Republican-led Senate, following the democratically controlled House of Representatives on Monday, passed the measure without Donald Trump's support, voting 81-13 on Friday afternoon. Overriding Donald Trump's veto marks a striking departure for GOP senators, who have largely stood by the president during his turbulent White House term. But Donald Trump's objections to the bill angered lawmakers, who had labored for months to put together a bipartisan bill and pride themselves on passing the military bill each year for 60 years, and voted to ignore his opposition to it. $740 billion National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, determines everything from military programs and construction projects to how to address geopolitical threats. Donald Trump refused to sign it into law because of his failure to repeal Section 230, a federal law that provides a legal liability shield for internet companies, and because it includes a provision stripping the names of Confederate generals from military bases. We've passed this legislation for 59 years in a row, and one way or another we're going to complete the 60th Annual National Defense Authorization Act and pass it into law before this Congress concludes on Sunday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said. As votes were being counted, indicating Donald Trump had lost the battle, the president tweeted, touting a protest planned in Washington on Wednesday when the new Congress officially tallies the Electoral College votes certifying Democrat Joe Biden's presidential victory in November's election. Meanwhile, President Trump returned to Washington on Thursday, abruptly cutting short a holiday retreat to his private South Florida resort as the president's allies on Capitol Hill prepare to mount a last-ditch challenge to Joe Biden's election victory on 6th of January. The president had reportedly been in a stormy mood since his arrival at Mar-a-Lago, where he decamped days before Christmas and was originally expected to remain through to New Year's Eve celebrations. It was not clear what triggered President Trump's change of plans. He declined to answer questions upon boarding for his flight back to White House on Thursday morning, 31st of December. But hours before the White House announced that Donald Trump would spend New Year's Eve in Washington, the Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri announced that he would object to the Electoral College result when Congress meets on 6th of January to affirm Joe Biden as the winner of November's presidential election. Donald Trump had been goading his most loyal backers in Congress to stage a final intervention on the floor of the House to try to overturn the results of the election. The effort to keep Donald Trump in power is all but destined to fail, but it will test Republicans' loyalty to the president, who maintains a vice-like grip on their party, even after Americans voted to remove him from office after a single term. Many Senate Republicans had hoped to avoid such a showdown over the certification process, typically a formality. The move by Josh Hawley, a conservative freshman believed to have presidential ambitions, will force his colleagues to publicly affirm or oppose the election results. Donald Trump has refused to concede spending his last holiday season as president fuming over his loss. On Twitter, the president continued to amplify conspiracy theories about voter fraud and lashed out at Republican officials who have refused his demands to overturn his loss in their states. On Wednesday, he called on the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, to resign, even though multiple recounts affirmed Joe Biden's narrow historic victory in Georgia. It is worth noting that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell effectively denied Donald Trump's demand that Congress increase the size of coronavirus relief checks to Americans from $600 to $2,000.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am.
pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. The tradition which I will share with you, dear brothers and sisters, today is a very thought-provoking one, in which Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, you know, a person who witnessed this type of act or this type of behavior for certain individuals, that when a person performs an act of disobedience, a sin, a forbidden act, well, there's one thing. But if a person enjoys what he's doing, it's a completely different kettle of fish. The Imam says, and or this hadith that is reported from the Imam alayhi salam, he says that beware of enjoying the sin. For verily that enjoyment is worse than the actual perpetration of that sin. That you are taking enjoyment in disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, why did I mention in the beginning that the Imam saw this? That we see that on the day of Ashura, that those individuals actually, for the sake of this world, enjoyed doing what they did. They took, some of them actually took pleasure in it. The hearts were so bad, the hearts were so, you know, dark and black, that they took pleasure in it. And this is actually dangerous. Why? For a second, is that the heart of that individual will be so hard that remorse cannot, you know, manifest itself from such a heart. That you are enjoying disobeying that very same source that has given you every single thing that you have. He's given you the ability to perform, na'udhu billah, that sin. And then you're also enjoying it. This is why the Imam is saying that this is like a double, you know, bad effect on you. So do not only, you know, refrain from sins, for there's one thing. But imagine you're a person now, not only not refraining, but taking, you know, pleasure in disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is something extremely dangerous, something that we as individuals need to pay attention to. That if, for example, I give you a very simple example. Eating haram money is something, obviously, is a sin. You know, for example, getting money for, that is riba, money from interest, is something that is wrong. But imagine a person who enjoys cheating other people. He enjoys earning that haram risk by cheating on other people and getting money in by any means necessary. This type of person, how can this person deal with community around him? So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that this type of sin, that first of all we are protected from sinning. And if, na'udhu billah, we do happen to commit the sin, that we don't enjoy it and we are remorseful immediately after performing it. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost.